This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, our correspondent Rana Bakker assesses the situation in Gaza, once again sealed at the border following the recent attacks on Egyptian soldiers in the Sinai Peninsula, for which Palestinians are being blamed without evidence and punished by the Egyptian authorities.
The only party that is benefiting from the attack is Israel.
Also, rampant power cuts in Gaza leave Palestinians in the dark during Ramadan. Gaza mourns the mother of a detainee who passed away while on the bus traveling to see her son after years of Israel's imposition of a family visitation ban. Palestinian prisoner Hassan Safadi is still on hunger strike after Israel renews the administrative detention order against him. Meanwhile, former hunger striker Bilal Diab and female prisoner Warud Qasem were released from Israeli jails back to their homes in the West Bank. Also, why the bubble in the foreign aid-dependent West Bank economy is about to burst. Bogus charges of anti-Semitism aimed at stifling criticism of Israel create a real climate of fear for Arab and Muslim students in the U.S. A concert promoter who raised money for the Israeli army will hold a Lollapalooza music festival on the ruins of a Palestinian village next year. And a British energy firm ditches occupation profiteer and private security giant G4S. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We go first to the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent and blogger Rana Bakker reports that last weekend, 16 Egyptian border guards were killed in an attack in the Sinai Peninsula near the Gaza border. The attack, which was carried out by gunmen who have still not been identified, was blamed on Palestinians in Gaza by Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, which is headed by Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi, despite any full investigation nor evidence. Following the attack, Tantawi was quick to issue collective punishment against Gaza by closing the Rafah crossing, the only crossing for Palestinians in Gaza to the outside world. Tantawi declared that both the crossing and the hundreds of underground tunnels are to be, quote, indefinitely closed. These border and tunnel closures are, as Bakker explains, directly affecting the health and economy of the Gaza Strip, whose approximately 1.7 million Palestinian people have already struggled under severe closures and import and export bans imposed by Israel's blockade, which has been ongoing now for 5 years. Bakker explains that Amr Moussa, the former Egyptian Minister of Foreign Affairs and presidential candidate, supported the measure and stated that the closure of the crossing must be accompanied with the closure of the underground tunnels. Bakker added that the young revolutionaries who made the highest sacrifices during the revolution that ousted Hosni Mubarak condemned the decision and even used social networking websites to voice their opposition to Tantawi and his brutal policies towards the people of Gaza. Joining us to talk about this is our blogger and correspondent, Rana Bakker. Rana is a student and a member of the Gaza-based organizing committee for the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement against Israel. Rana joins us from Gaza City. Rana Bakker, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So talk about the attack last weekend at the Egypt-Gaza border and the reaction by Egyptian authorities and how, as you put it in your op-ed, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, is blaming Palestinians in Gaza based on speculation and not on true evidence. Talk about what's going on here.
It was very depressing to receive the news of the closure of the Rafah crossing and underground tunnels, because we believe that the Palestinians in Gaza were not behind the attack. And it's not going to be surprising if you say that Israel plotted the attack itself, because the only party that is benefiting from the attack is Israel, and this is what many people who believe. The Gazans actually, even if it was proved that Gazans were part of the attack, we see that the entire population should not be punished for something a very small minority and a very small number of people are perpetrated. Also, we think that the Egyptian authorities and SCAF, in particular, punish the people of Gaza not based on true evidence. They're only doing this based on speculations, based on doubts and all that. So it is not even fair to punish an entire population, especially when Egypt, when the Rafah crossing, when the tunnels are the only way for the people of Gaza to live. The tunnels for Gaza are very, very important for us in Gaza. They are the way we bring basic needs the way we bring food, the way we bring medicine, the way we bring everything we need. Also, with a very high rate of unemployment in Gaza, Syrians do employ many people. So we see that this will also make it very difficult here, and will make the even economic situation deteriorate, because many people now turned out to be unemployed as a result of the closure.
Rana, can you talk about the relationships many people in Gaza have had to Egypt over the years? In your op-ed, you talked about how Egypt is at the heart of summer plans for families who can leave, how there's been solidarity between the people of Gaza and the people of Egypt during the Arab uprisings, and how Palestinians famously stormed the Rafah crossing in 2008, demanding an end to the Israeli siege. Talk about how these things have changed over the past week.
Well, I think before the Egyptian revolution, the people of Gaza believed that the people of Egypt, and we were talking about the people themselves, not even the government, we believe that they don't care about Gaza, they don't care about the blockade, they don't care about their brothers and sisters here. But when the revolution was sparked, everything changed. The people of Gaza started to believe in the people of Egypt, especially when we say that the opening of the Rafah crossing as one of the demands of the revolutionaries in the Tahrir Square and in the many squares across Egypt. So this relationship has dramatically changed since the revolution. But today, with the closure of the Rafah crossing and especially after the attack, many Palestinians, especially those who have Twitter accounts and blogs, were regularly attacked by many Egyptians. But still, we believe that these people who continue to attack Palestinians, they haven't even supported them. We believe that they've never supported our cause, and they've never supported us, and that they're still loyal to the old regime. But the actual revolutionaries, those who sacrificed the most during the revolution, continue to criticize CAF, continue to criticize the policies of Tantawi, and they're actually also demanding that Mohamed Morsi takes steps and tries to improve the situation here in Gaza, and to open the crossing, to open the tunnels, and to try to even heard calls on Twitter and on many Egyptian blogs for the cancellation of Camp David, which we here in Gaza consider as a very important issue.
Anything else you want to say about this situation? What do you think is going to be the next step in this investigation, if it's still ongoing, or in Israel's response or Egypt's response? What's the situation in the next coming days and weeks?
I don't know how things are going to happen, but I think that our hope lies in the people, because if the people go out again to the Tahrir Square, if they demand the opening of the Rafah crossing, this will make everything change. This will force staff and will force the Egyptian government to open the borders. But I think that when Mohamed Morsi yesterday fired leading military officials from staff itself, I think it was a very, very good move. Because these officials are corrupt. They are the ones who suspect the revolutionaries. They are the ones who work for Mubarak. So I think that Morsi is starting to take a good step, but we hope that, because these steps obviously are not enough, because we haven't seen a change yet, but let's hope that the situation will be better and that the people of Egypt will act.
That was our correspondent and blogger Rana Bakr speaking to us from Gaza City. For more on this story, read Rana's op-ed on our front page at electronicintifada.net. Writing for Interpress Service, Mohamed Omar in Gaza reported that during this year's month of Ramadan, which is celebrated at night when people break their daily fast, most celebrations are happening in the dark or by candlelight, as electricity cuts in Gaza have become a part of daily life. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA, the Gaza power plant has been operating at best at a third of its capacity, or has been completely shut down by severe fuel shortages since February 2012. This has led to scheduled blackouts in homes of 6 to 18 hours a day, besides the random unscheduled cuts. Omer writes, quote, OCHA says the generating capacity of this plant has been significantly damaged after the destruction of six transformers in an Israeli airstrike in 2006. Restrictions on the import of parts and equipment to repair the transformers, lack of fuel as a result of Israel's blockade, and a dispute between the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and the authorities in Gaza over funding of the plant's operations. The power cuts are a price approximately 1.7 million Gazans pay for the Israeli blockade, which was imposed in 2006. An official from the Palestinian Energy Authority says the main reason Gaza cannot get more fuel is, quote, arbitrariness from Israel and Egypt and their failure to permit entry of fuel from Qatar. Qatar has donated fuel to alleviate the electricity cuts in Gaza, but according to the Energy Authority official, 90% of that fuel has been sitting in tankers in the Suez Canal for the past 2 months, awaiting approval from Egypt's military. The insufficient and irregular power supply has an adverse impact on Gaza hospitals, with outages having tripled since the beginning of 2012, according to the World Health Organization. UN statistics show that the average waiting time for orthopedic surgery at Al-Shifa Hospital, for example, increased from 3 to 6 months during the first half of 2012. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. We turn our attention to the ongoing situation for Palestinian prisoners and detainees and their families. This week, our correspondent Shahid Abu Salama reported from Gaza that the 75-year-old mother of Yahya Isleh, a detainee held in an Israeli jail, passed away on the bus while on her way to finally visit her son after Israel agreed to tacitly lift a family visitation ban. Lifting the ban was one of the conditions agreed upon after the month-long mass hunger strike by Palestinian prisoners that ended in mid-May. Yahya's mother, Aisha, waited 4 years to visit him, but never got the chance. The story made headlines across Palestine. Shahid Abu Salama wrote in her blog post that following the capture of an Israeli soldier in June 2006, Israel collectively punished Palestinian political prisoners from Gaza by banning family visits, one of their basic rights and a lifeline between detainees and their families. Last month, on July 16th, 48 family members were finally allowed to see their relatives in Israeli jails for the first time since the capture of the Israeli soldier, though they could only visit them through barriers for 45 minutes. However, Israel imposed its own conditions on the visits. Only wives and parents were allowed to visit. Detainees' young children weren't, quote, for security reasons. Fathers must imagine their children growing up without them, Shahid Abu Salama wrote, or wait for the miracles of their smuggled pictures. For more on this story, visit Shahid Abu Salama's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. Meanwhile, Palestinian prisoner Hassan Safadi has relaunched his hunger strike after finding out that Israel reneged on a previous deal to free him. Our correspondent Lina Al-Safan reported that after 71 days without food, Hassan initially broke his hunger strike a day after the May 14th agreement signed by the Israel Prison Service and the Higher Committee for Hunger Strikers. Under the deal, Safadi was to have been released at the end of June. After Hassan Safadi relaunched his hunger strike, he was promptly placed in solitary confinement once the Israel Prison Service found out. He was moved to the Ramleh Prison Hospital on Tuesday, July 10th, where he still remains in isolation. According to the latest examination by Physicians for Human Rights Israel, he is suffering from kidney problems, sight problems, extreme weakness, severe weight loss, headaches, dizziness, and has difficulty standing. His mother told the Electronic Intifada, quote, "We were 100% sure Hassan was going to be released. I still have hope he will be released." Thursday marked Hassan Safadi's 50th day of this renewed hunger strike. In addition, Lina Al-Safan reported that on Thursday, 27-year-old Bilal Diab was released at the Jalameh checkpoint in the northern West Bank and finally went home to his family near Jenin after 77 days of hunger strike. Bilal Diab was arrested last year in August and was given a 6 month order for administrative detention, indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial, which was renewed in February. He started and ended his strike along with Thaer Halahla, another administrative detainee who was released in early June. After Israel had renewed the detentions of Hassan Safadi and Omar Abu Shalal, there were doubts as to whether Bilal would be finally released, but he was released back to his home in the West Bank this week. Meanwhile, 25-year-old Wurud Qassam was also released on the same day after the Israeli authorities decided to grant her an early release based on medical reasons. Wurud was sentenced to 6 years in prison after being arrested in October 2006. Lina Al-Safan adds, quote, Samer al-Bark is on his 80th day of hunger strike. Two prisoners who were released in last year's prisoner exchange were re-arrested by Israel in violation of the deal's terms and are also on hunger strike. Ayman Shawarna is on his 41st day and Samer Issawi is on his 10th day without food. For more on these stories, including interviews with family members of hunger strikers and released prisoners, visit Lina Al-Safan's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. A bubble in the economy of West Bank cities, towns, and villages managed by the Palestinian Authority cannot be sustained, according to analysts. In a report by Gillian Kessler-Damour for Interpress Service, the Palestinian Authority has announced it is facing a funding crisis. It is now relying on donor aid to cover a budget deficit of $1.1 billion and a cash shortfall of $500 million. Kessler-Damour writes that Salam Fayyad, the Palestinian Authority's prime minister, has nevertheless pushed economic development and investments in the private sector as a means to secure a Palestinian state. To date, most international economic bodies and foreign governments have praised Fayyad's approach, pointing to Palestinian gross domestic product growth rates as a measure of its success. Palestinian GDP grew 7.7% between 2008 and 2011. In its 2011 to 2013 development plan entitled Establishing the State, Building Our Future, the Palestinian Authority estimated the GDP would grow by 12% in 2013. However, a World Bank report released in July found that the Palestinian economy is unsustainable. The report said that removing Israeli restrictions on market access and to natural resources is the necessary first step in expanding the Palestinian private sector, and that the PA must stem its reliance on foreign aid. The unemployment rate in the West Bank during the first quarter of 2012 was approximately 20%, data from the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics found. The Bureau also found that a quarter of Palestinians in the West Bank lived below the poverty line in 2011, while almost 13% of Palestinians lived in deep poverty in a West Bank Palestinian population of approximately 2.6 million. According to an economist in the report, the Palestinian Authority leadership needs to acknowledge the realities of building an economy under Israeli occupation and change its policies in order to alleviate the financial burden many Palestinian families now face. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that an attempt to portray Palestine solidarity campaigning on campus as, quote, anti-Semitism has failed once again at the University of California at Berkeley. Lacking evidence that would support their complaints, a group of Zionist students had to abandon a federal lawsuit and reach a settlement accord in late June. But this will almost certainly not be the last case of its type. Across California and elsewhere in the United States, well-financed lobby groups working closely with the Israeli government continue to file various lawsuits against universities, alleging civil rights violations against Jewish students. The real intention, however, is to chill Palestine solidarity activism and censor open discussion about Israeli policy in classrooms. Though the lawsuit has proven unfruitful to the plaintiffs, they asserted that they would bring the same complaints against UC Berkeley to the U.S. Department of Education, citing violations of Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which protects against discrimination based on race or national origin in institutions that receive federal funding. However, this Title VI complaint may be in violation of the settlement contract and the court's dismissal of the suit. The settlement agreement released all claims against the university and was dismissed on the basis that the plaintiffs cannot file the same complaint again. But the plaintiffs associated with the on-campus Zionist group are pushing forward anyway and filed the Title VI claim on July 9th. This lawfare tactic, using civil rights laws to claim prejudice against Jewish students because of Palestine solidarity activism or Muslim student organizing, is being regularly practiced by Zionist groups across the U.S. The tactic has been pioneered and coordinated by Kenneth Marcus, a pro-Israel activist who previously headed the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, which handles such complaints. Apparently responding to campaigns by Israel lobby groups, including the Zionist Organization of America and the Anti-Defamation League, U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan announced a new set of guidelines in 2010 that specifically, quote, applies Title VI to the protection of Jewish students from anti-Semitism on campuses. Even so, Israel lobby groups have yet to make any legal headway using various strategies in California and across the U.S. Various Zionist and Israel lobby organizations have filed civil rights complaints against universities across the United States, but none have succeeded in court. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Electronic Intifada's Benjamin Doherty reported this week that Lollapalooza, the corporate concert franchise founded by Jane's Addiction's frontman, pro-Israeli fundraiser and activist Perry Farrell, is to launch in Tel Aviv in August 2013. Farrell previously raised money for Israeli army soldiers during Israel's Operation Cast Lead, the massacre of Palestinian civilians in Gaza in the winter of 2008 and 2009. The Lollapalooza Music Festival, held annually in Chicago, is run by the company of noted Hollywood agent and brother of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. It will also be held next year in an Israeli park built over the ruins of the Palestinian village of Jerisha, whose residents were forced to flee their homes under attack by Zionist militias in 1948. The announcement is certain to fuel the international campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which has appealed to artists with increasing success not to play in Israel due to Israel's systematic denial of Palestinian human rights. In other news, the Electronic Intifada reported that British firm Good Energy has announced that it will end its business relationship with G4S, the private security giant with a track record of complicity in Israel's human rights abuses. Good Energy claims to be committed to high ethical standards, but has contracted a G4S company to conduct door-to-door energy meter readings since 2008. G4S provides equipment and services to Israeli prisons and checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, and has been involved in serious abuses in the UK deportation system and other privatized services that were previously in public ownership. The recent decision not to prosecute G4S or any of its staff over the role in the death of Jimmy Mubenga, an Angolan who died on a deportation flight while being, quote, restrained by G4S guards, has sparked outrage. In a statement published on its website last week, Good Energy hinted that it had felt the pressure by campaigners, saying that, quote, feedback from customers was one of the reasons behind its decision to drop G4S. This small but significant victory shows that the rapid emerging campaign against G4S is already succeeding in toxifying the G4S brand. For more news on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.